implementation matters, starting with paper 12E. Is that a lack of exchangeability?
Yes? No, we're going to annual improvement.
Oh, do the annual improvement. Okay.
Agenda papers 12E to 12I discuss feedback on the annual improvements exposure draft. We will start with agenda paper 12F, which discusses feedback on the proposed amendments to IFRS 1. Exposure draft proposed requiring a subsidiary applying paragraph D16A of IFRS 1 to measure cumulative translation differences using the amount reported by the parent at the parent's transition date to IFRS standards. Paragraph 9 to 29 include our analysis of the feedback. Based on our analysis, and in particular in the light of new information obtained about the possible effect of the amendment on some subsidiaries, we recommend that the board permit rather than require a subsidiary to measure cumulative translation differences using the amount reported by its parent. I will now direct your attention to question 1 on page 11 and ask whether you agree with our recommendation.
Rika.
I strongly support the staff recommendation. I can raise 3 points about this question. The first is the frequency of the issue. In my previous law, I received exact same question again and again every 2 years or so. And every time, we try to persuade the stakeholders that paragraph D cannot be used by analogy. So it's always continued. I come up with a question again and again. So, but I don't think this is an issue of the specific jurisdiction matter, because many companies consider the restructuring of their structure of the subsidiary and group entities. In that case, some subsidiary will be newly having a IPO or something things happen to apply the IFRS as a fast adapter. So that is the second thing. And the third thing is I think it is important to retain the original exception as status quo, because I think there is two patterns of the fact I can think of. The first pattern is when the subsidiary, which have group companies, but one structure is kind of the doing sub-consolidation at the subsidiary level. In that case, they are directly reporting the whole information in one package to the parent. In that pattern, they can receive great benefit from this amendment, because they can maintain, and they have maintained the original information when the parent company first adopt the IFRS. But the other structure is like when the individual group companies separately reporting to their own parent, or they use the different business stream type reporting line. In that case, it's not necessary that subsidiary doing sub-consolidation. In such a case, those subsidiaries do not have the same information as in the case subsidiary doing sub-consolidation. So if the case that subsidiary doesn't have a sub-consolidation reporting structure, they cannot benefit from the original the amendment originally proposed by the ISB. So I think alternative should be remain at status quo. So I strongly support staff recommendation.
Anne?
I also agree with permitting and not requiring. I know that that allows choice in the situation, and choice will mean diversity in reporting, and often we don't want to do that. But I think that you've presented the case here, considering the cost-benefit considerations, and I think it's appropriate that we allow it to be permitted, not required. I think being required would be inappropriate. It would impose costs, as you've set out in the paper, so I do agree with the staff.
And Joe?
I think, yes, I agree with staff's recommendation. Just a question. Rika mentioned, and also the paper also mentioned, the view from ASBG, the different structures. There is a parent, a subsidiary, and a subsidiary. And the parents directly consolidated the financial statement prepared by the subsidiary. But here we actually we try to, you know, provide some kind of accounting treatment for the subsidiary, not for the parents, not for the subsidiary. Yeah. So in this case, because the subsidiary controlled the subsidiary, so and that subsidiary apply IFRS standards. So in my understanding, because it controlled the subsidiary, that subsidiary should, you know, apply IFRS 10, consolidated the financial statements prepared by the subsidiary. So in this case, even the parents may directly consolidate the subsidiary, but for the subsidiaries, I think that if they apply IFRS standard, they should also, you know, consolidate financials prepared by the subsidiary.
I think the timing, the parent company transit to IFRS, and the timing, the subsidiary transit to IFRS, is different. So
it's okay. Yeah, time may be different. Yeah, but yeah, I just make sure because that subsidiary should consolidate. That's a subsidiary.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So there is a number, but maybe the data is different, yeah, as you mentioned. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and this is a situation where the subsidiary is coming along and being a first-time adopter of IFRS later than the parent. So it may not have, you know, tracked the currency translation, you know, differences on the subsidiary that it now, you know, is consolidating in accordance with IFRS before that date.
Okay, can we see if we support the staff recommendation? Right.
Sorry, Sue, what was the vote?
14.
14.
So, good afternoon, everyone. Agenda paper 12G analyzes feedback on the proposed amendment to IFRS 9 in the annual improvements exposure draft. Paragraphs 5 to 10 summarize the proposed amendment, whilst paragraphs 11 and 12 provide an overview of feedback. Almost all respondents agreed with the proposed amendment for the reasons outlined in the basis for conclusion. Nevertheless, some respondents expressed concerns about particular aspects of the proposal. Paragraphs 13 to 37 discuss these concerns, and paragraphs 38 to 40 discuss feedback on the proposed transition requirements. Finally, paragraph 41 discusses other comments. Based on our analysis, we recommend finalizing the proposed amendment to IFRS 9 with no changes. I would like to draw your attention to question 1 on page 12 and ask if you agree with our recommendation.
I do agree with your recommendation, and just commenting specifically on the request of some to amend IAS 39. I agree with the what we proposed, which was only amending IFRS 9. My recollection of the discussion at the Interpretations Committee was it was actually a very sort of close thing whether or not the committee thought that we needed to make an annual improvement. It was done to make it a little bit easier to read, but I don't think we expected really there to be a different an outcome. So I agree with what's proposed.
Any other comments, questions? Do we agree?
Agenda paper 12H analyses feedback on the proposed amendment to illustrative example 13 accompanying IFRS 16 included in the annual improvements exposure draft. Paragraph 5 summarizes the proposed amendment and paragraphs 6 to 10 provide an overview of the feedback. The feedback was mixed, with approximately half agreeing and the remainder disagreeing. Paragraphs 11 to 26 consider the alternatives proposed by respondents, and paragraphs 27 to 30 present our view on how the board should proceed. On balance, we recommend finalising the proposed amendment to illustrative example 13 accompanying IFRS 16 with no changes. I would like to draw your attention to question 1 and page 11 and ask if you agree with our recommendation.
Do we agree? General?
Just one comment. Is there any way to keep that example with your nice additions in the appendix?
So, Changu, I think as part of our process, we went through and we contrasted the alternatives that were set out in the letters, and one of those, as you rightly point out, was to have the additional example in the Appendix B. We decided on balance that, considering the timing, that it would maybe be our better option would be to continue with the amendment as proposed, but it was an alternative we considered.
So our recommendation is not to
Just consistent with the exposure drafted.
That's right. Yeah.
Because in the end of the day, I agree that we still have some questions, but it would go beyond the scope of the amendment. That's why I'm agreeing with just deleting the paragraph, the example, without taking into consideration the two alternatives that are here in the appendix.
I agree with most of the analysis, but I support the alternative B to be more helpful to people, not make the issue totally disappear.
Barry?
I also support the staff's recommendation, but I think we should probably note, one, the issue, an extant issue, is not going to go away. But two, we have a PIR coming in a year or two on this subject, and this can easily get swept into that. But to reopen what is a reimbursement and lease incentives or not is not a quick discussion, because you certainly make an argument everything is a lease incentive as part of the negotiation, and that will go on for a while. I would hold it for the PIR and deal with it in a few years.
Jin Chao?
Yes, I exactly have the same view as Gary said. I think the issue would be with regard to the whether reimbursement is a lease incentive or not, not really actually relevant to those examples, actually. So it's better to be addressed PIR in the future, not currently, because it will disrupt the implementation of IFRS 16. Yeah.
I agree with the staff recommendation. It's always good to be helpful, but I fear that if we made this amendment at this point in time, it might be unhelpful to a number of people who have actually done something different. And they've just started applying the standards. So.
Can I see who supports the standard?
Rika's got her card up.
Thank you. I think it is truly important to minimize the change from what we have already exported and received the feedback. And checking the comment letter from the stakeholders, I truly think we shouldn't make any additional thing within example, because if we include something, it might be helpful, but that can lead unconsequence or unintended consequence and get more question, because of this is a kind of the pervasive question about these incentives.
So you want to put your hand up?
Yes. 14. 13. Oh, 13, sorry.
Okay, again. The last agenda paper on annual improvements discusses feedback on the proposed amendment to IS-41. The proposed amendment would remove the requirement to use pre-tax cash flows when measuring fair value using a present value technique. Paragraphs 7 to 15 include our analysis of the feedback. Based on our analysis, we recommend finalizing the proposed amendment with no changes. I will now direct your attention to question 1 on page 5 and ask whether you agree with our recommendation.
Just one suggestion from a non-native speaker. I would add to the transition prospectively, just to make it clear. As we did for IFRS 1, for example, there is one example that is in the IFRS 1 D20. Mm-hmm. When we say that would apply the amendments prospectively to fair value measurement on or after the date. I just think that it makes clearer the document.
If it makes sense, we can think about that in drafting. I mean, if it's helpful to explain, typically in more recent times in transition requirements, we typically try not to use the word retrospectively or prospective because it can mean different things to different people depending on the situation. So what we've been trying to do more recently is draft the transition requirements to state exactly what you need to do. However, I mean, we can think about that in drafting.
My main point is that what should we do with any difference between the new way of calculating the fair value and the previous way? And that shall we treat this within equity or in P&L? If I include prospectively, it's just clear that's P&L. That's why.
Okay. Can I see? Supports the staff recommendation.
14.
Paper 12C, is that correct?
12A.
I give the floor to Vincent.
Good afternoon, everyone. So now we'll now move to agenda papers 12A to 12D. These agenda papers discuss the Interpretations Committee recommendations about possible narrow scope standard setting regarding lack of exchangeability. The purpose of today's session is to explain the background of this project and ask whether you agree with the committee's recommendation to undertake narrow scope standard setting on this project. This is the purpose of agenda paper 12B. If you agree with this recommendation, we will then discuss the committee's recommendation about the content of standard setting, which are set out in agenda papers 12C and 12D. We will not ask you to make any decision about those specific recommendations. However, as explained in paragraph 8 of agenda paper 12A, we will welcome any comments and suggestions that you may have about those recommendations. We will start the discussion with agenda paper 12B. Paragraph 5 to 18 of the paper provide background information about the project. Paragraphs 19 to 35 analyze whether the matter meets the criteria for narrow scope standard setting. In particular, I highlight that the lack of exchangeability arises relatively infrequently. However, when those circumstances arise, the situation can deteriorate rapidly and can have a material effect on the amounts reported by entities that are affected. We conclude in paragraph 36 that the matter does meet those criteria for standard setting. I will now turn your attention to the question on page 9 of the paper and ask whether you agree with the committee's recommendation to undertake narrow scope standard setting.
Dale?
So actually, I support the staff recommendation. It's just worth mentioning that sometimes people may see that project as some countries investing in countries that are experiencing this lack of exchangeability. But if you just think about the country that is suffering this problem, the entire jurisdiction, the preparers, they don't know exactly what to do. That's why it's not so infrequent receiving questions about what we should do. And then that's why I fully support going for this narrow scope standard setting project.
Good job.
Thank you, Ms. I also support staff's recommendation. I think we should undertake a narrow scope standard setting project to address the exchange rate when an entity, an entity can use when exchangeability between two currencies is lacking. I look at the two agenda decisions we made before. It seems that only focusing on which exchange rate we should apply is not enough, because we have to, without defining what's the meaning of the exchangeability, what's the meaning of the so-called long-term lake of the exchangeability, and even I think agenda decision in 2018 mentioned about the official rate. Even we mentioned the official rate, but if there are several official rates available, which rates we should apply, and also I think in some jurisdiction maybe there are official rate, official market. Sometimes there are no non-official market available, and the entity can get access to that non-official market. So what exchange rates should apply? So all those issues, I think, should be addressed through narrow scope standard setting project. Secondly, how to approach this narrow scope standard setting project, their approach A and approach B available. I agree with approach B rather than approach A, because approach A is too narrow and only address the issue arising one specific country. I think it's not, maybe not subject to that specific country. Other countries maybe have similar issues come out. It's reminded me in China, I think when China adopted the reform and open up policy of 30 years ago, actually, there are similar issues about the exchangeability of those foreign currency issues there. So, and also it reminds me in 1997, during the Asia financial crisis, before that, some countries, their foreign currency are exchangeable, but because of financial crisis, some countries actually have some kind of regulation. And have some restriction for those companies to exchange their local currency to foreign currencies. So that means it's not only subject to that specific country, or maybe some other countries or some specific situations will also have similar issues. So I agree with the staff's recommendation to use approach B to do this narrow scope target standard setting project.
Sue?
So focusing on question 12B in the first instance, yeah. I also agree with the staff's recommendation, the committee's recommendation, to the board to do narrow scope standard setting in this area. I think it's actually important that we do projects like this, because it's showing how, as an organisation, we can be responsive to needs that arise internationally at points in time. and by our standards on a relatively timely basis. I think it's also a good indication, example of how the board can work with the committee to address issues, and it was, I think, useful that the committee in the first instance dealt with what it could do promptly based on the existing literature, which was just to make sure that people weren't feeling compelled to blindly use the official exchange rates, but then knowing that there was a gap left to do something as a second step. So I strongly support the proposed recommendation.
Darrell?
Piling on a little bit here, but I support the idea of going forward with the project. I believe that this is an issue it's described somewhere in the paper as widespread. I'm not sure it's widespread, but I think in those jurisdictions where it has an impact, it has a significant impact. And so I think it is something that we should be doing. I think the way Sue expressed the working together with the committee and the fact that we are seen to be responsive, I think, are all valuable things that we need to take into account. I agree with the idea of approach B. I think that the approach B is the better approach, so I'm comfortable with that. I do think that some of the devil is going to be in the details, and there are a few more questions as we get into the papers in depth that, although I still agree this is narrow scope, I think it is going to be it's going to have some complications. But I like the fact that the committee has worked through a lot of these issues and at least given us an initial step.
I also agree, because I think during the last maybe 2 or 3 years, I think there was not any GPF meeting where I was not approached, that this is a problem and really has an impact on entities which have subsidiaries in this kind of countries which have this issue. And as Sue, I think it is important that we react to this kind of stuff, because it is also, I'm hearing that in companies and also investors are confused because the results when you using this exchange rate, which is not exchangeable, can be a little bit odd. And therefore, I think it is necessary that we do something.
Françoise?
I support the analysis of the committee that we do and setting on the basis of approach B.
Anne?
I thought the paper set out clearly what the issues were, what the problem was, what was missing in IAS 21, where it was silent. And also diversity in practice. So in terms of narrow scope standard setting, I thought that was all covered. Where I had my question was about the word widespread, which Darrell's picked up on, and how big a problem this is, because every time we take on a project, it means resources are not going on something else and different things get prioritised. But something that helped me think about it was that even though it might be one country, there are many other jurisdictions involved, because this is a cross-country situation. And I think that's what Martin is touching on when he talks about GPF. So having heard the discussion today, I'm happy to support it.
Mary?
I wanted to go back to something that Sue said. She talked about demonstrating that we can respond and follow up. But I think also it is... I support doing the project because... I support following the recommendations of the Interpretation Committee. I think as a board, I look at this and say, do I have any concerns about their analysis of whether it meets the criteria, et cetera? And, I think that's a good mix of people from a range of jurisdictions with a range of responsibilities. And so just a reminder to let ourselves be guided and kind of sanity test. I think our role is more sanity testing rather than redoing what the committee has done on these things. So, support their recommendation.
So like Martin, when I've been at GPF meetings, I've heard this as a regular issue that's raised. I'm not sure that widespread is the right word, but when it happens, it has a very significant impact, which is perhaps a nuance. Yeah. There, it's not happening to every entity, but it's very significant when it does.
I think the widespread is it's not limited to entities in that country, but rather it's around the world in the sense of anybody who has an investment in that.
Yeah.
Okay, who want to help Martin and Nick to get GPF off? They're back.
14?
14? So now we will move to agenda paper 14C. This agenda paper sets out the committee's analysis and recommendations on how to define exchangeability and, accordingly, a lack of exchangeability. Paragraphs 7 to 71 of the paper present the committee's analysis in this respect. Paragraphs 72 and 73 summarize the committee's recommendations. I note that the approach recommended in this paper is to be prescriptive in defining when a currency's exchangeability is lacking. I will now drive your attention to the question on page 18 of the paper and ask whether you have questions or comments on the committee's recommendations.
Well, when I read paper 12C and I read the analysis, I agreed with the committee recommendation. But when I moved to paper 12D and reasoning around, you know, the proposal there, I differ from the approach that is described in 12D. And that has made me move to alternative four, having availability for the entire exchange. Beyond that, we would be in a lack of exchangeability. I'm not going to comment on paper 12D before it's introduced. We'll come back later. And you'll see that. Ultimately, even if we were going for alternative four, in the way I think about it, we would have the similar outcome.
Daryl?
I thought I agreed with the direction you were taking. This is where I started to get slightly worried about some of the details. So I think in many of these types of transactions, the intent does matter. So it's not just about what you need to have. One particular intent might trigger exchangeability and a different intent might not trigger exchangeability. So perhaps a dividend flow makes for exchangeable, but sale of shares doesn't. And so I'm slightly concerned about how we deal with that going forward. And then I think the if I look at the recommendation set out in paragraph 5, if I look at C, I assume C is, in discussing enforceability, is taking a slightly different nuance on the legality versus non-legality. So we're not opining on that part of it. We're simply saying if I have an enforceable transaction, even if it is what is, I think, sometimes termed as a parallel market, that is nonetheless acceptable for what we're doing.
I agree with the approach in terms of trying to define exchangeability in a simple and straightforward way and then use some guidance about how that can be applied. But I agree with Daryl that I think it's going to get complicated because of the judgment. I don't see another approach, so I do support this approach. I don't see another way you can do it. I just think it is going to get difficult when we get into the judgment. I noticed that you used the word significant. This paper turns on the use of the word significant, and I assume that that's intentional. I don't see that you can use a word like material in this setting. I'm sure you've thought about it. We have had discussions recently about substituting the word material for the word significant. Okay, we're going to continue with the word significant, but I would just ask for you to have a little think about how you're framing paragraph 68, which is your recommendation, because when I read the sentence, an entity is unable to obtain more than an insignificant amount of foreign currency, doesn't flow very well for me, and I'm a native English speaker and it doesn't flow well for me. So it engages me. I have to think about this word, this word, this word, and they're all in conflict with each other. So I did have a problem there, and I wondered whether you just say, you don't use this insignificant word, but you just say something is significant or it is not significant. Because I think that's a much more straightforward way at coming at what you're trying to do. It's exactly the same as what you're doing, but this I wasn't comfortable with the sentence. It's just a thought.
So I'll start at where you finished, Anne, and then I'll come back to the other stuff I was going to raise. So I also tripped a little bit on the words. Yeah. And I tripped in particular the way it was articulated in paragraph 66, where I felt like I was falling over double negatives. So my suggestion is if we could try and switch it around the other way a little bit, maybe something like exchangeability is lacking when an entity can obtain no more than an insignificant amount of foreign currency. I think no more than an insignificant amount is different than a significant amount.
Yeah, that was the thing I was thinking about.
We need
to
be careful. I agree with the suggestion focusing on no more than an insignificant amount. But I think we need to be comfortable with that, given we've chatted a lot about what those words mean in the context of IFRS 9 when we looked at the ECL model. So we just need to make sure that what we've said there is sort of okay. I think it is, but you guys should check. I agree not focusing on materiality, because I think we're trying to make materiality a sort of financial statement-wide concept, and that's different to here. A couple of other points. So I agree with the approach you've got here. I think we will need to focus in particularly on one point that Daryl mentioned. When we were at the Emerging Economies Group in Argentina earlier in the year, there was a lot of focus / concern on how we articulate which rates you can access, whether we mean legal, whether we mean enforceable. That can make a big difference in some of these jurisdictions. So I think that's going to be an area that we need to make sure we get really good input on and make people really focus on that point. And I think the other area, which is going to be a little bit tricky, but we will probably need to work out what we, or the committee or somebody needs to work out what we say on it, is this unit of account point. Because if we're looking at, you know, how much of a particular transaction can I, you know, do in the foreign currency, then how are you collecting them or doing them individually could make a difference in the assessment. So I think we'll need to look at that. So the devil is, I'm afraid, going to be in the detail, but I still think it's good to do it.
To Dale.
Thank you, Hans. I support the staff's recommendation. I thought about the same as Anne was discussing, whether there is something, another way to say that there is a lack of exchangeability. It's quite difficult, especially because if we start thinking too much or getting some flexibility, it's likely that if you don't clearly draw the line, people will just jump to say that there is a lack of exchangeability and go to agenda paper 12D and then to decide what would be the most convenient exchange rate. I mean, that I think that we should use a more objective criteria for determining whether there is a lack of exchangeability or not. That's why I support the staff recommendation. But there are still some items open. One that Sue just mentioned, that's about the unit of account. That's quite important. Sometimes you may have exchangeability for one transaction, but might have or not most of the other transactions. And also, there is a concept that the translation of financial statements used as a basis of determining the exchange rate, those that are used for remittance of dividends. And then I might have, in some jurisdiction, many different exchange rates. It's something that also I think that would be interesting when dealing with unit of account and et cetera, deal with. That's
it. Gary.
Thank you. I also support the staff's recommendation of going narrow scope. Standard setting, and then for the most part, agree with the direction of travel you're outlining in here. Just a couple of quick reactions in here. First of all, I think it's been a while, unless my memory is totally gone, that we've done any work on foreign exchange and rate setting and so on of any consequential. I mean, I know there's tactical stuff in projects, but broadly. And so I think that's a good subject for us to work on. I also think this is a different issue than, you know, the hyperinflationary, what's the line for hyperinflationary thing that, you know, pops up, you know, regularly in agenda consultation and so on. So this something fair. That's just a line. You know, this is actually a real-life practical problem in the world. I think we need as a group to accept that there is not going to be any perfect answer. There's going to be, we need a practical answer, and I think that's where you're going in here. I think, you know, in this case, you know, we could go on forever about macroeconomic theory of inflation and currency flows and stuff, or you come up with a practical answer, and I opt for the latter in here. I think this is a limited circumstance situation at the moment, and I think any understandable guidance that can provide comparability is better than a really deep theoretical answer that macroeconomists will disagree on. So that's why I support this for the various reasons. I think on balance you got the place to go. I would raise one question. I'll go back to, I guess, in paragraph 6E, even though I think it came up elsewhere, when you talk about an insignificant amount of foreign exchange, I think we're going to have to answer the question. Insignificant doesn't mean zero, but 12D talks about it's lacking. You mean, is there a gap in between? There's no exchangeability or only insignificant amount? Is there a small middle ground in between, a little bit and none? I don't pretend to know what the answer is. I just think that answer will have to be provided in the course of this. And I do agree with Daryl. Intent probably has got to be a factor into here. Again, I'm not suggesting what the answer should be, but I don't think it can really be ignored, because if it's dividends, for example, that is very much discretionary inside the company. And what do you do, so on. Again, maybe we conclude it's not a factor, but I think it's got to be in the staff discussion paper someplace.
It's different types of intent, isn't it? I think that you were talking about, do I intend to actually exchange, whereas you thinking about what's the sort of transaction I'm thinking about. And I think I would agree, we do care about that. So it's shades of intent, I think. But anyway, to think about.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Vincent, because I think that this sort of recommendation, when we talked about it, is if there's, it's almost like if there's almost just one rate or sorry, I'm not going to be very clear, but I think your example, Darrell, which is maybe where we do care, is when, and I think your example was you might have a different rate for selling shares versus remittances. So what you're saying in terms of recovering your net investment in this, say, subsidiary, there possibly could be two different rates depending on intent. And I think what you're saying is...
No, it's not the same.
So we should think about that, whereas what we were intending here is almost...
Do I settling or not?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's two different.
Yes. Correct.
Well, we try to capture with this recommendation the fact that you have access to an exchange mechanism, but simply you don't like the exchange rate because you think that it is not faithfully reflecting the economic condition, and then you refrain from exchanging. And in that case, we say you don't consider the intention, you consider the legal accessibility.
So we can pick up this point in the next paper we bring back.
Yeah. Mary?
I think I'm going to make a bit more processy comment. I was going to comment about the intent too, but that just covered my concern. I think it's going to be hard on the one hand to be disciplined about scope creep, because there are a lot of interesting issues that we could maybe be helpful about in this area. But I think, again, this is, from a process perspective, something we should rely on the interpretation committee for. Maybe there's some things we'll challenge them on, but to get their recommendations about which issues we should address versus which issues we should set aside, even if they're interesting or it would be nice to tidy up. And I think what we bring to the table on this is maybe more around things like, where have we seen problems in standard setting before? And it's something like the too many double negatives mean it isn't that clear in practice, and other problems that we've had kick up before. So I think we're each, both the board is going to have to be advised by the interpretation committee, maybe challenge the interpretation committee if we think there's scope creep in terms of what they're recommending. But I think we have to use the interpretation committee to keep us disciplined about not trying to clean up everything that's been nagging at us in this area. Around exchangeability, et cetera, and do what we have to do rather than nice to do.
Yes, thank you. I think I support this project as long as this nanoscope amendment disrupts the fundamental requirement of IS-21. So I think it's important about when an entity assesses exchangeability or lack of exchangeability. So when I look at paragraph 73B, it said consider its ability to obtain foreign currency and not its intention or decision to do so. I think I understand that what the IC want to address in this condition, but I still are wondering there might be a little more clarification about what its ability to obtain. Is that really the issue of capability of the entity or the entity's ability to access the foreign currency for exchange? So I understand the meaning, probably the latter one,
So I think I don't think there is any issue to say it could obtain in paragraph A or other part, but just want to have a little more clarification on that one.
Tom?
Yeah, a couple of comments. One is we'll have to be clear about what constitutes an enforceable right in a market. I'm not quite sure how that translates. I would need a little bit more when we get there. The other one I had, and it may be the same as Francois's, I'm a bit concerned with the interface of C and D. And it's almost impossible without kind of just highlighting the concern. In D, there's three conditions. It seems to me that if we do the one that's recommended from C, it would not be consistent with the second and third in D, which I'll say why. I guess the other one seemed to talk very much about an economic representational faithfulness in D. And so when I ask myself the question about when I look at if it's, I think I agree with Sue, if I heard her correctly, more than insignificant is not the same as significant, which suggests there's something in between. And as you get down to these smaller amounts of funds, the ideal world, you can, nice deep market, you trade as much as you want. So we're moving in the recommendation fairly far away from that. And that's where the representational faithfulness will kick in later. I also had on the same line, and just if I read A8 correctly in the example. I just want to make sure I have it right. In this case, as I understand, if the entity could trade, could do as much as it wanted, however silly the rate, it would have exchangeability. And again, that to me seems in conflict with, in other words, if I made the 10 to 1, if the purchasing power parity was 5 to 1 and you have 10 to 1, say I made it 10,000 to 1, mm-hmm. as long as I could do it, and we're getting farther and farther from the representational faithfulness. So I wanted to raise that because I'm sympathetic, though, in that in C, it seems to me you minimize the number of times we have to do estimates. And I think maybe Gary was talking about what's the pragmatic thing to do. And so, okay, here we have a rate. It's fairly far in some cases from representational faithfulness, but at least it's a rate because, as you point out, talking about what the normal rate would be is really hard. And the theories are, and I remember doing stuff in purchasing power parity, and entities tend to move, or exchange rates tend to move to real purchasing power parity, but they do it very slowly, and they can do it in one of three ways. And so when we talk about a point, it's going to get very hard. So I'm sympathetic to C, but I am concerned that I see a bit of a conflict in C and D. And I might even buy that, okay, if I make a sequential set of decisions, that the first decision is to minimize the number of estimates, and therefore we'll go with C. Mm-hmm. And then if you're forced into an estimate, we'll try and make it representationally faithful. But doing that, having allowed some pretty not representationally faithful in C, and I'm going to be uncomfortable with that all the way through. It may be that you'll convince me that pragmatically that's the best way to go. But I just wanted to kind of signal. I don't know if it's the same as Francois had, but anyway, so, and I think Gary was useful in instilling in me that we do need a pragmatic solution.
The other thing I'll just say to that, Tom, and I understand everything you said and get it. And again, I'm looking at my expert Vincent here in case I say it wrong. Is I think in thinking about the point that you made and the circumstances, you know, where potentially you don't get into what we'd call lack of exchangeability in C, but you might be, you know, what you might say, force or whatever, have to use a rate that looks quite different from what, say, would reflect the economic circumstances. I wonder whether to kind of if we were to try and solve that, I might say, I wonder whether that would mean more substantive changes to IS-21. And the only reason I raise that as a question, tell me if I'm wrong, Council, is that at the minute in the definitions we have in IS-21, you know, you're always using, you know, a spot exchange rate, and that spot exchange rate is defined as the exchange rate for immediate delivery. And so even though if you take your situation where, say, the rate is set at a very, what you might call, non-economic rate, I still think if that rate is there and would be available to you, it probably is the rate for immediate delivery. So all I'm saying is I understand the point you're raising, it's just perhaps addressing that might mean a bit more to...
And again, it depends where you want to have... There's going to be some kind of a undesirable element to this. I can't see there not being... If it is that we do the one that we're doing, that maybe we have to ease off a little bit on two. In other words, if we say that it's more than insignificant is fine, then we interpret economic representational faithfulness with that as our target and not a most logical, rational, arm's length, you know, knowledgeable traders in a nice deep market. And maybe that gets us out of it a bit.
Mary.
But on this point, I think we have to be very careful that we say step away from using an observable rate. We have to be very careful that we do not open the door to saying step away from an observable rate if you do not agree with it. So let's say you had an economic rule of thumb that said, I will use my UK pounds to buy Canadian dollars whenever the rate is X or better. Now, does that mean that you think that any rate that is below, you know, not as good as X, means it's not economically faithful and therefore you should be using your target rate for translation of any transactions because it's only at that rate that you would be willing to execute transactions? And I think if we go a route that says assess the reasonableness of the rate that is observable and decide whether or not to use it, that's a very, very different analysis. And I think it's a much bit, you know, as Petrina said, a much bigger change to the standard, but it also asks companies to say, do they agree with where the market is at the reporting date? And I think there's, you know, what the paper sets out is a reasonable cut, and I don't know if Gary would agree or not, but I think it's a practical cut that says you only ignore what is observable in the market if the amount you could transact is so small, it's insignificant, that it really doesn't give me evidence. So I think it's really important that we stick with I see the tension that you highlighted between if you say as a result of 12C that there's lack of exchangeability, what is it that you're trying to estimate, and you then try to estimate something that might be closer to your rule of thumb exchange rate. You know, I will buy Canadian dollars if the rate is better than X. I see the tension between that and, you know, the example that you pointed to in 12CA8, but I think it's important to have the discipline of A8 that says you may think that this market is really mispriced, but if you could transact for more than an insignificant amount, then you're stuck with it and use it. So I think it's healthy to identify the tension in the thinking between the two, but I see the merit in the discipline in 12C.
Sue?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to come back to a much more basic comment, which I think is words, but just for you to think about. So as I understand it, looking at the diagram that you've got to illustrate your logic in paragraph 56, whether or not something's a more than insignificant amount depends on what the entire amount of the transaction is that you're thinking about, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So... If I look at 12C, on page 18, little e, and it says unable to obtain more than an insignificant amount of foreign currency, they could only get $1 million US dollars. Whether or not that's insignificant will depend on whether I'm trying to exchange 1.2 million or 500 million. And I don't get that relative to what concept in the wording we've got in E. It sounds like it's an absolute notion, whereas you mean a relative notion. Yeah.
Daryl?
And this is thinking on my feet a little bit, but just thinking about the discussion that's gone around about the insignificant versus the whole amount and et cetera. A number of the jurisdictions we're talking about, the smaller jurisdictions have less liquid markets. And in some circumstances, what they would find is if they were to try to settle, for example, their entire liability on a given day, that would be a market-moving event. And so I think if we were to apply there, you have to be able to settle the whole amount. I think we also get into a really tricky space in terms of just that type of thing. We're trying to measure a point in value, not trying to say you must settle it all now to get. And I just think that shakes the whole thing in terms of, to my mind, sticking with the definition we've got with that, rather than trying to go for a greater amount. And I think it's also consistent with the way we think about other things. We don't require, whenever you use a fair value type measure, for you to justify that you can actually place everything you have at that value on that date.
Jabu.
Thank you. I generally agree with the step recommendation, but as some board members suggested, the scope of this amendment might be different from what we intended to provide, because maybe the Jing Zhao said in old China there was some temporary problems in exchanging the Chinese currency with some others for 3 months, maybe 6 months. Also, even some other countries, there might be a very low frequency of transactions in exchanging these two currencies, their currency with other currencies, for the time being. So as Mary suggested, whether this kind of exchange rate is normal or fair value rate, a kind of thing. So what I'm saying, I feel some kind of a tension between the proposal here and the difficulty issues raised before by many countries. They might think this might be applicable to their situations. So we need to be somewhat careful in clarifying what our intention to cover by this amendment. So another thing is because of taking the approach B, more broader amendment than the narrow targeted one, for doing that you suggested in paper B, paragraph somewhere, because there are some other jurisdictions somewhere, this kind of issues some exchangeability, but not as extreme as Venezuela. So you open some kind of a scope of this amendment. So just I'm wondering, some other countries are, oh, what, this is good news. We can use estimated exchange rate right now on. But that's not our intention, right? We are just dealing with very small issues. However, based on all these writings of all the concepts here, might open some kind of possibility using estimated exchange rate to some other transactions that we are not considering. So that's why I'm saying we need to be maybe adding some more clarification on the concept of or kind of description of this exchangeability. So that's my concern. There might be some unintended consequences of the approach B. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm concerned.
So just to your point, Chung Lee, that's kind of what we are trying to address in 12C. So we've got quite a long list of different sort of criteria, I might say, or conditions in a sense that, that we're at least suggesting or the committee's suggesting would need to be met. And as we've said, C and D work together, that at least at the minute, if we're going to go with allowing the use of an estimate or requiring the use of an estimate when exchangeability is lacking, then in C we're trying to define quite narrowly and actually quite prescriptively when exchangeability would be lacking. I mean, I don't know if you think there's anything else we should consider other than what's in C. Is there anything else?
The C, paragraph 73, for example, C, we have to consider only markets and exchange mechanisms that create enforceable rights and obligations. That description is very nice. However, this description does not limit the scope of this amendment, might still open some kind of possibility, opportunity for other jurisdictions to utilize and estimate the spot rate. So, you know, you would consider markets. But in those markets, maybe they are exchanging these, the foreign currencies, not so maybe many enough. So people are thinking, oh, even though we consider the markets here, our markets of exchange, but we conclude that this transaction is not enough to conclude. There is a kind of fair, a kind of economically representing, you know, exchange rate. So in that case, we can, those countries might say, we are having, you know, difficulty in lacking of exchangeability. So that's what my concern. That's not what we are intended, but anyway, that's
all. If it's helpful, we'd be saying you've got to meet all of the conditions in 73 for it to be, for exchangeability to be lacking. So you can't just pick any one and say exchangeability is lacking. We're saying you need to meet all.
Yeah, we need to meet all of these criteria. So this is quite restricted scope. But still, we might need to add some kind of a criteria in, for example, C. Mm-hmm. You should consider markets and also some kind of a enough number of transactions in that markets. That kind of a additional phrase. No?
I'm not quite catching, but I mean, we can pick up afterwards if it's helpful. I'm not quite catching what that says to me about enforceability.
In a case of the IFRS 13, when we developed the fair value measurements, some part of the standard is saying fair value measurement, the fair value rate, the fair value price is in a normal markets with a kind of orderly markets. So there are transactions, the prices are reasonable, acceptable by many older participants. But in some cases, the market is not so volatile, or there are not so many transaction in those markets for the time being, maybe some months. In that case, we are giving some kind of relief of fair value measurement. You can use some others rather than just observable prices in those markets, that kind of thing. So if we apply that kind of logic here, then maybe some jurisdictions might think, oh, this is a new amendment that opens some kind of flexibility using a kind of estimated spot rate, estimate price in a sense. So just
I think that the test that the staff has proposed about could you transact more than an insignificant amount is the expression of that assessment of the depth and usefulness of the market in which you are observing something. So I think the staff has thought about it. It's maybe been expressed a bit differently than it is in IFRS 13, but it's going to the same thing, because if the market is so thin that you could only transact an insignificant amount, then you would not use the rate from that market. So I think that criterion picks up the concerns that you have when you're thinking about the IFRS 13 and the characteristics of the market. So I think we're covered.
Councilor Bowser.
Well, we're stepping into the selection of inputs. I don't know whether you want to introduce 12D first.
Maybe would that be helpful if we introduce 12D and then talk about it all together?
Yeah, I wait.
So for agenda paper 14D presents the committee's analysis and recommendation on the spot exchange rate that an entity should use when a currency's exchangeability is lacking. Paragraphs 7 to 10 describe the committee's proposed approach, that is, that an entity should use and should estimate the spot exchange rate when exchangeability is lacking. Paragraph 16 to 42 discuss how an entity would apply that approach. Paragraph 43 of the paper summarizes the committee's recommendation. So I will now turn your attention to the question on page 14 of the paper and ask whether you have comments or suggestions on the committee's recommendations.
As I said earlier, it's when I came to this paper that I changed my mind about the lack of exchangeability. And I did change my mind, but I didn't move away, I think, from the reasoning that had been going on through the two papers. And I see where I differed from the recommendation, and maybe you have a good reason to give to me that will make me change my mind again, but what surprised me in reading 12B is that the consideration of an observable rate, let it be not exactly the rate that applies to, with the same purpose, was to be permitted. The consideration was permitted but was not required. And some references, some comparisons have already been made with the IFRS 13 logic. And we start with observable rates, and then eventually we adjust the market inputs that are available. And only when we have gone out of any form of market inputs, we go to modeling. And that suggested exactly the same approach to me. And so if we had the lack of exchangeability that kicked in when the full amount is not available, the first, and you would be in the same flowchart that you have by the end of the paper, but the first step would be that if you have an observable rate that applies to your transaction, you would apply it. And basically, you would have the same outcome as for whatever is more than insignificant amount. You don't have that, you move, but I would move it as a requirement to the observable rate, which is not exactly, and I would use that if it meets the criteria that have been set by the committee, and only after that step I would move into estimating on the basis of a model. I think it's totally, I think, consistent with the approach, but I think it's more streamlined, and we may still have the notion of more than insignificant in one way or another, because it picks indeed what Mary said, that that observable rate is relevant only if it in itself an evidence of the spot rate, but it would not play such a significant role anyway. So that's why I came.
Can I just ask a question, Françoise, if it's okay? Would you, because I understand what you're saying, that at the minute in this paper we were suggesting, you know, estimating, and then we're saying if you've got something observable for, say, on the date but for a different transaction or at a different date, you're permitted to use it in a sense. Would you, and I think you'd be saying, well, look, if that's available, always use it, almost have it as a requirement. Would you, in terms of, you know, thinking about the hierarchy and thinking about the case when there's an observable rate for a different transaction or an observable rate in a different date, would you require use of it only when it would meet a particular objective, like the objective we have in here about reflecting the economics? Or would you always require that rate regardless of whether it met a particular objective?
I accepted the criteria that are on the paper.
Okay, so yes, so you'd have the objective and you'd say if you've got an observable rate that meets that objective, then use it.
Yes,
basically.
But I would not have, you can consider it.
Yeah, yeah.
You use it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you, Hans. I agree with the staff recommendation. I just want to make a clarification here on paragraph 43, when they say that, it said that the committee recommends that an entity estimates spot rate when exchangeability of occurrence is lacking, and an entity would use that estimate rate both when, and then just to be consistent with paragraph 26 of IS 21, I may have to use different exchange rate. Then in this case, just to be sure that even if I have to estimate, I may need to estimate more than one.
Yes.
That's correct.
Okay. That's right. I can see how that wording's confusing, but yes, that's right.
Mary?
Two questions that I'd like to ask you to think about as you develop further papers. And welcome any comments now, but it's more for the papers. It's in paper 12D, paragraph 43. One is about paragraph B, little 2. When you're setting out the objective would require an entity to estimate a rate that, 2, would have arisen in an orderly transaction between market participants. I'm fine with that, but that seemed to be the one that was closest to but isn't exactly the same as enforceable rights and obligations. And I would have thought that we would have, we would have looked to the criteria we used for testing the exchangeability and kind of translated those here. So just if you could think about why or why not that would either fall into B2 or some other criterion is question one. Question two, I'm not sure, and I can take this offline with you, that the drafting that you've sketched out here accomplishes keeping IS 21 paragraph 26 that says for foreign currency transactions, if there's a rate observable before the financial statements are authorized for issue, you must use that. As I thought through the logic you sketched out here, I thought we could end up having a conflict between what paragraph 43 produces and what 21.26 requires in one case. And I assume that your objective is not to change the requirement in 21.26. Is that correct?
No, we were thinking that if we go this route, we would change
okay.
that.
Okay, that's fine. I was trying to read this in the context of thinking that you weren't, so you probably did. You accomplished that, because I was like, oh, I don't know. I think this is going to change that.
Carol?
At the risk of seeming like I've got an obsession with legality and illegality, just looking at D and looking at the 5BI, would I be correctly interpreting this that if I failed exchangeability under C, because I only had access to a parallel market in which there was not enforceability, I would nonetheless, under this paragraph, be able to say that I could still refer to that parallel market to get a rate.
An observable data that an you observable might data point consider
only because of the failure of the previous
the estimation process.
And then just a broader comment to Francois, and this is maybe something we can pick up outside of after the meeting, but I still have reservations about us requiring the entire amount, because I think that might push a lot more into the space. And even though I agree with you, we could push people to get the same outcome, you're still requiring a lot of entities and jurisdictions where there is less, either what I'd call more more normal type exchange control mechanisms in place, they would have to go through, I think, this whole process. And I think that would be my reservation, is it's just this expands beyond what we think of a narrow scope thing to actually mean it's a much broader scope thing. And but I'd like to make sure I've understood that properly, but we can do that outside of this discussion.
Any other comments? We don't need any votes.
bring us to the end of the presentation. Okay, yes. It's part of the conversation, isn't it?
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Conclude our deliberations. We have.
I do not have to assist you more than if you think.
Piece of paper. Please set up the paper for discussion.
Good afternoon. Agenda paper 12J provides the board with a summary of information we've identified in our monitoring of crypto assets. And before discussing this information, I thought it might be helpful to remind you of the history of discussions on this topic. The holdings of cryptocurrencies first came to the attention of the board back in December 2016 at a meeting of the ASAF, where the Australian Accounting Standards Board presented a paper on this topic. The topic was then discussed by the board on several occasions during 2017 and 2018, and these discussions include both holdings and issuing of crypto assets. In November 2018, you decided not to add a standard-setting project to your agenda to discuss to address any aspect of crypto assets, and at the same time, you asked us to monitor developments in this area. So given a year has passed since you made that decision, we thought it would be useful to provide you with a summary of the information that we've obtained, and that's what paper 12J does. We're not asking you to make any decisions at this meeting, and this paper is for your information only. But I'll now ask whether you have any questions or comments on the contents of the paper.
Are you going to explain why Canada is so shady area?
We have to get excitement somewhere.
Yeah.
So we do crypto. We have nice, peaceful politics.
You talk about the cannabis and then you invest in crypto.
Just a really small question. France is issuing something, but you didn't give any descriptive stats on France in your survey. I'm just curious.
So the French ANC, the standard the ANC issued is French GAAP, so it only covers entities that would apply French GAAP. We didn't identify any French entities applying I4S in our search.
I suppose that your paper demonstrates that this far it was a wise decision for us not to get too excited about this. Anne?
So you, thanks for the paper, Craig. And you do show us that there are now more IFRS entities, largely thanks to Canada. But there are more IFRS entities with the crypto assets than when we previously looked at it. But the way I did read your paper was that the situation doesn't change in terms of us thinking that we should be taking a project on or doing more than we've already done, given the agenda decision. I didn't feel that the landscape had changed, and in fact a lot of the material that you presented in the paper would reaffirm our decision to just continue watching, because you've given us some research evidence that indicates that these markets are unstable, unregulated, there's evidence of what looks like market abuse and consequently legal actions around that market abuse. So there doesn't seem to be any evidence to suggest we should change our monitoring position.
I mean, I can only speak from our perspective. There wouldn't be any information that would change my decision if I was a board member, but
of course, if Libra would get off the ground, which remains to be seen, then we would have a different ball game.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that, what that might mean for us?
I think in terms of Libra, I think one of the things that the Interpretations Committee suggested was in terms of the definition of cash. And so just now in IS7, cash is defined as, I think it's cash on hand and cash deposits in bank. That doesn't really give you a description of when something becomes cash. So I think one of the things the Interpretations Committee, if Libra goes the way that Facebook might want it to, it would be quite widely used, and it might be helpful to have some kind of description about when something becomes cash.
So then it might just fit in one of our standards as they are.
It could do.
Yeah.
It could do, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
It could too. We'd have to look and see whether, because our standards at the minute don't say much about cash, so we'll probably have to look at whether, if it became sort of more prevalent and used, we might have to look.
Then it could just be treated as cash, most likely, or possibly. Yeah. Okay. Riga.
Yep.
It's another country with some...
Yes. I'm from the jurisdiction which has a very passionate about the crypto asset, but considering the my past experience dealing with the accounting implication of the crypto asset, I don't think at this moment I agree with the staff's analysis that there is no stable condition on the platform. We can stand and reopen the discussion over how to deal. So I think keep monitoring the environment and stakeholders' mood. I agree with that. I don't need to express my opinion here, but I think this is a reasonable way we conclude right now.
Mary?
An observation and then a question for Hans. The observation is that we did say we wanted to monitor, and that's not, I think it's good that when we're monitoring something like this, it's not just going on in the background, but from time to time we get, recap and an opportunity to ask questions in public. So thanks for doing this, and I think it's a really good job in terms of looking broadly at it. And the question for Hans is, you focused in on Libra and whether or not that would change it. What I infer from your question is that if a class of stable coins that are actually backed by cash on deposit, emerges, do we have to look at the question of whether the stablecoin represents a right to cash, and is that the question that you had in the back of your mind?
The question is, if Libra gets off the ground, it will be big,
mm-hmm.
most likely,
mm-hmm.
and it will be approved by regulators.
Mm-hmm.
So it moves out of the more shady areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have to have an answer, I think. But it might be, that's why I asked that question. If the answer is simple, it could be cash, then problems are resolved. And probably.
Or there
might
be a whole load of new ones.
Well, we'll see. But it remains to be seen whether it can get off the ground. Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of this month's board meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.